Welcome. This is the online course on the Nibbana Sermons 1 to 11 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Nyanananda, hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg, in collaboration with the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we are looking at Sermon number 4. But before I get into that, a few things from the very rich discussion in relation to sermon number 3. One important point made by Linda Grace when she quotes Venerable Nyanananda's statement that what we call the Dhamma eye is the ability to see the Nibbanic solution in the very vortex of the samsaric problem. That way of analysis which puts samsara and nibbana far apart into two watertight compartments, as it were, gives rise to interminable problems. She says, to me the key here is this nibbanic solution. He's not saying nibbana and samsara are the same. Vision? No, that nibbana is some kind of separate existing place one goes to after samsara. She adds that there can be the idea that Nibbana is some kind of pleasant experience, a certain state of mind that feels very present, open, transparent, and expansive. In fact, these kind of experiences, when the hindrances may be temporary at bay, are sometimes even taught, at times implicitly, but also at times quite explicitly, as timeless, unborn, undying consciousness. I found this a very pertinent warning not to lose the essence of the teachings by watering it down. Then there was a comment and an offering by Robert, just to show that Paticca-samuppada is not a linear chain of links as we are tempted to think. And he made this drawing, and I just thought that it was very nice to start the lecture with that. So we can see here consciousness and name and form in their reciprocal conditioning. And then with different colors, he has shown that there is a kind of overlap between various links. And I think in order to appreciate that, let me just see that you can see the whole rest of it. We need to keep in mind that each of these individual links does not exist on its own. At each situation, time, experience described with any of these links, all of the 5 aggregates are there. So when there is ignorance, this ignorance is not something that kind of floats around on its own in empty space, but it's something that manifests as part of the 5 aggregates. And when we come to sankharas, then even though the emphasis is on sankharas, at that time body, feeling, perception and consciousness are there. So this maybe helps a little bit to explain the, at first sight, perhaps a little bit puzzling impression that there's like an overlap of different factors. And I think that this design and the statement by Robert really help us to get out of that kind of thinking. And as Tiago mentioned, whatever it may be, the fact is that many of us find ourselves looking at this list and its constituents and attempting to treat it as a whole thing and analyze it as a globally self-consistent system. This is, in fact, indeed the natural tendency of the mind. And Mikens pointed out that unlike some other modern interpretations where birth and death are redefined as birth of a self and so on, and hence avoiding a literal rebirth altogether, for Venerable Nyanananda, birth and death seem to have their usual meanings. Yeah, I also think that's the case. And then Simon Adam Leonard, he raised the point that related this, how to understand Paticca-samuppada to the question of akalika, of timelessness. And he says the common explanation of anicca draws on the concept of continuous change, which is inherently in the realm of time. Change, be it continuous or discontinuous, shows itself only in an elapsing of time, that it is kalika, not akalika, which is a quality of the Dhamma. And I wanted to mention that we have to be a little bit careful not to overtake this qualification akalika I mean, I don't think when the Dhamma is, the teaching is qualified as archaic, this means that anything that has to do with time is kind of being devalued. And I also sure that Leonard doesn't mean that he's just raising the point. I mean, just think of the gradual path. Or think of Satipatthana Sutta, which at the end has this different list of time periods it takes for Satipatthana meditation to bear fruits, from 7 years all the way down to a few days. Clearly, there is a time period involved is not a problem as such. And Venerable Dhammadina points out that temporality as a category of subjectivity depends on conditionality and thereby on impermanence. The cessation of craving for presently arising experience itself, illusion, takes the mind out of time because it takes it out of conditionality, which is the source of the subjective experience of time. That is, timelessness is attained by letting go of presently experienced conditionality. Very much to the point. And then another comment by Robert. To me, his main point seems to be that it is not necessary to see previous lives in order to see dependent arising, which is seeing the Dhamma. I think that Venerable Nyanananda's primary focus is to shift our focus from thinking about three life theories and from aiming for supernatural powers in order to observe reincarnation firsthand, to observing the workings of conditionality and change in the present moment. And I thought this was also a very pertinent remark. In a way, much of the teachings of the Venerable Nyanananda are pointing back to the actual meaning of things, which often has been lost sight of due to over-literal interpretations. It would be not in keeping with this type of teachings if we ourselves then take what Venerable Nyanananda says totally literal and don't try to make an effort to see, instead of looking at the finger, to look at the moon. That is what we should try to do, I think, to which the finger is pointing. And so, on this whole topic of how time and paticca-samuppada relate to each other, I wanted to try a little illustration. Some participants have appreciated 2 weeks ago the illustration of how the five fingers of name take hold of the pen of form to write the story of experience on the paper of consciousness. And so I thought of trying bringing another of these illustrations I have, and I will be using this ruler and my cup. And so the ruler, I suggest, is the 12-link interpretation of dependent arising. It's very nice and three-dimensional and complex, and I want to really understand its how it works and what it means, because that is the way to see the Dhamma. And so, in addition to its exploring its three-dimensionality, I also want to relate it to the fourth dimension, to the dimension of time. And I am using my cup here to illustrate as a representative of time, in a way as a container, time as a container for this 12-link formula. So I take my 12-link formula and I start with the dukkha end and I start to place it into time. And as I begin, it works very nicely. There's death. And then death and old age leading, being conditioned by birth. And this is clearly gives me the feeling of a very neat temporal sequence. And so with that interpretation established, then I continue to move on. And I get becoming and clinging and craving and feeling. And now I'm getting stuck. Because even though the earlier part really worked very well as a temporal sequence, when I come to feeling, contact is something felt. It's not so much that contact comes first and feeling comes after. And the six sense bases and consciousness, actually, they're coming together as contact. So in a way, this what worked for the first part or the lower part to place it in time and see it as a temporal sequence, it no longer works for the upper part so well. And I'm kind of stuck with my attempt to bring the 12 links into the container of time. At this point, then, the first thing to do, I suggest I do, is to look at what traditional exegesis has made out of this. And here we find a very interesting situation that if we look in the Theravada tradition, the Patisamvita Magga has the three life interpretation. But the Patisamvita Magga actually builds on a work of the canonical Abhidhamma, the Vibhanga, and the Vibhanga has the one mind moment interpretation of the 12 links. And if we look at the Sarvastivada exegetical tradition, we get the exact same thing, but in the opposite direction. The Jnanaprasthana, which is an important canonical Abhidhamma work, has the three life interpretation. And the Mahavibhasha, important work that builds on Jnanaprasthana, then has the one mind moment interpretation. And so what this says to me, first of all, is that in both of these great Abhidhamma traditions, the Theravada and the Sarvastivada, the three lives and the one mind moment interpretation were not seen as conflicting with each other. It was apparently not such seen as you have to decide for one or the other. But at the same time, my problem that I demonstrated here has still not really been solved. I can't really stick my 12 link interpretation into this container of time. So when faced with this situation, now let me take another look at these 12 links, leaving the time aside for the time being. Now, the next step after looking at the tradition exegesis is to look at modern scholarship. And here there is this finding that I mentioned by Yurevich, where she points out that the 12-link formula stands in dialogue with an ancient Indian idea, with the Vedic creation myth. And I think this is, to me, this is one of the most important contributions made by modern scholarship to understanding of Paticchasamuppada. And I understand it to mean that in order to express some new discovery, the Buddha had to use existing ideas in order to create some degree of familiarity. So this 12-link formula, particularly the first part that I couldn't get stuck into my time cup, has a lot to do, it stands in dialogue with ideas that we can be fairly sure were in existence in ancient India. It creates a sense of familiarity through the sequence. And then there comes the point that whereas the Vedic creation myth then leads on to the wonderful mythical creation of the world, the 12 links lead up to the rising of Dukkha. This is like a turning around, giving a completely different twist to the whole series and creating an aha effect in the audience. And then on top of that, the whole dimension of cessation, which is obviously not part of the Vedic creation myth, that not only does this lead up to Dukkha, but if you get out of it, you get out of Dukkha. And so I take it that this made an effect on the ancient Indian audience that nowadays, because we are no longer familiar with this background, we don't get that effect. And so we are kind of stuck. We are holding on to these 12 links in an attempt to understand them and get a little bit sidetracked by the details. And so what this suggests to me is that I can drop the 12 links. And then there's just the hand left. Before, when the hand was holding the ruler, we were not really seeing the hand. Just as when looking at the 12 links, I might get so involved with the details that I don't see the principle that stands behind it. And this is the important teaching given by Venerable Jnanananda, that we want to see that principle itself, that specific conditional, the idapachayata. And now, when I'm allowing that, and I'm not dismissing the 12 links in any way, but just putting them aside with all due respect for the time being in order to see the principle. And as I see the principle, my hand has now become free. I'm no longer holding on to the ruler. It can hold on to other things. And what happens is, it can also take hold of the cup. What I'm saying is that I am actually become able to realize that time itself is also dependently arisen. Even though it is not part of the 12-link formula, it is not mentioned as one of the links explicitly, time is also a dependently arisen thing. It is not a container, and I was wrong to think of it as a sort of pre-existing container into which I can put my 12-link formula. And to excuse myself for having had this idea, I mean, time in the way we experience it is so influential in our lives. We have measured it and put it up into different compartments. And much of my life is about my time, owning time. Don't waste my time. I don't have enough time. And the whole hierarchy of relationships is built around time. Who is to wait for whom? Who has time or does not have time for whom? So it is perhaps excusable that I thought of time as some sort of container within which I fit things. But as I'm now applying dependent arising that has been freed from excessive concern with the 12 formula, 12 links, to time, I realize time is also conditioned. It's also something dependently arisen. And now I can do the same thing with time as I did earlier with the ruler. By taking away the cup, the hand remains, the left hand, that I was not seeing before because it was holding on to the cup, just as I didn't see the right hand because it was holding on to the ruler. And now the left hand is the principle behind time. And what is that principle? It's just change. Time is just our conceptualization of change. What has changed? The past. What will change? The future. And what is changing now? The present. And when I'm saying what is changing now, of course we are not saying momentariness. We are saying that change is something arises. It persists for some time as a changing process and then it disappears. And so when I have this understanding of time, and then to come back to Robert's design here, I don't have any problem with any of the links. Whether they arise simultaneously, or whether they arise over a long time distance, even from birth all the way up to death, they're changing. Doesn't matter. And so what's happening now is that with change, understanding the principle of time to be change, the idea of change, the principle of the 12 things to be dependent on specific conditionality, the two actually match beautifully. No conflict anymore. In fact, dependent arising is change. The two are sides of a single coin. Because it is dependently arisen, it is changing, and it is changing because it is dependently arisen. Almost, I can't separate the two. We're just talking about two sides of the same coin. And having in this way integrated the two perspectives of Paticca-samuppada and time as change, what remains is the question of akalika. And this is when contemplating change, at some point the mind sees through. And conditions and change disappear when the unconditioned, the timelessness is experienced. That is the Dhamma eye. That is the full understanding of Paticca-samuppada by directly experiencing its cessation aspect. itang santang, itang panitang, yadidang, sabba sankara samato, sabbu paripatinissango, tanhakkayo virago nirodo nippanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor and the Assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks. Towards the end of the last sermon, we were trying to explain how the process of the samsaric journey of beings could be understood even with a couple of terms itta bhava and anyatta bhava, or thisness and otherwiseness. On an earlier occasion, we happened to quote the following verse in the Sutta Nipata. Tanha dutiyo puriso nigamadhana saṃsāraṃ itta bhāvanyatta bhāvaṃ saṃsāraṃ nāti vattati. It means, the man with craving as his second or as his companion, faring on for a long time in saṃsāra, does not transcend the round, which is of the nature of a thisness and an otherwiseness. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. With craving as partner, a person, wandering on this long journey, does not transcend saṃsāra, with its becoming thus, becoming otherwise. End of comment. This is further proof that the two terms imply a circuit. It is a circuit between a here and a there, or a thisness and an otherwiseness. It is a turning round, an alternation or a circuitous journey. It is like a rotation on the spot. It is an ambivalence between a here and a there. It is the relationship between this thisness and otherwiseness that we try to illustrate with quotations from the suttas. We mention in particular that consciousness, when it leaves this body and gets well established on a preconceived object, which in fact is its name and form object, that name and form attains growth and maturity there itself. Obviously, therefore, name and form is a necessary condition for the sustenance and growth of consciousness in a mother's womb. It should be clearly understood that the passage of consciousness from here to a mother's womb is not a movement from one place to another, as in the case of the body. In reality, it is only a difference of point of view, and not a transmigration of a soul. In other words, when consciousness leaves this body and comes to stay in a mother's womb, when it is fully established there, that place becomes a this place. From the point of view of that consciousness, the there becomes a here. Consequently, from the new point of view, what was earlier a here becomes a there. What was formerly that place has now become this place, and vice versa. That way, what actually is involved here is a change of point of view. So it does not mean completely leaving one place and going to another, as is usually meant by the journey of an individual. The process then is a sort of going round and round. This is all the more clear by the Buddha's statement that even consciousness is dependently arisen. There are instances in which the view that this self-same consciousness fares on in saṃsāra by itself, tat evidam viññānaṃ sandhāvati saṃsārati ananyam, is refuted as a wrong view. On the one hand, for the sustenance and growth of name and form in a mother's womb, consciousness is necessary. On the other hand, consciousness necessarily requires an object for its stability. It could be sometimes an intention or else a thought construct. In the least, it needs a trace of latency or anusaya. This fact is clear enough from the sutta quotations we brought up towards the end of the previous sermon. From the Cittana Sutta, we happen to quote on an earlier occasion, it is obvious that at least a trace of latency is necessary for the sustenance of consciousness. When consciousness gets established in a mother's womb, with this condition in the least, name and form begins to grow. It grows, as it were, with the flush of branches, in the form of the six sense bases, to produce a fresh tree of suffering. It is this idea that is voiced by the following well-known verse in the Dhammapada. Yathapi mule anupadnave dalhe chinnopi rukko punareva ruhati evampi tannanusa ye anuhate nipbaddati dukkang idang punnappunna. Just as a tree, so long as its root is unharmed and firm, though once cut down, will nonetheless grow up again. Even so, when craving's latency is not yet rooted out, this suffering gets reborn again and again. Comment, translation by Carol Norman. Just as a tree, although cut down, grows again, if the root is undamaged and firm. In just the same way, this suffering returns again and again, if the latent tendency to craving is not removed. End of comment. It is clear from this verse too that the latency to craving holds a very significant place in the context of the samsaric journey of a being. In the Anguttara Nikaya, one comes across the following statement by the Buddha: Kammam kettam vijnanam bijam tanha sineho. Kamma is the field, consciousness is the seed, craving is the moisture. This, in effect, means that consciousness grows in the field of kamma with craving as the moisture. It is in accordance with this idea, and in the context of this particular simile, that we have to interpret the reply of Tsela Thiri to a question raised by Mara. In the Sagatavanga of the Samyutta Nikaya, one comes across the following riddle put by Mara to the Arahant Nun Tsela. Kenida pakatang bimbang konu bimbasa karko kvanno bimbang samuppannang kvanno bimbang niruddhati. By whom was this image brought? Who is the maker of this image? Where has this image arisen, and where does the image cease? The image meant here is one's body or one's outward appearance, which for the conventional world is name and form. Tsela Thiri gives her answer in three verses. Naidang atta katang bimbang, naidang parakatang aghang, hetum paticca sambhutang, hetu bhanga nirujhati, yatha anyatarang bijang, kette vattum viruhati, pataviya rasan chagamma, sinehan ce tat ubhayam, evam khanda ce dhatu yo, cha ce ayatanaime, hetum paticca sambhuta, hetu bhanga nirujhare. Neither self-wrought is this image, nor yet other-wrought is this misery. By reason of a cause it came to be, by breaking up the cause it ceases to be. Just as in the case of a certain seed, which when sown in the field would feed on the taste of the earth and moisture, and by these two would grow, even so all these aggregates, elements and bases six, by reason of a cause have come to be, by breaking up the cause will cease to be. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This puppet is not made by itself, nor is this misery made by another. It has come to be dependent on a cause. If the causes break up, it will cease. As when a seed is sown in a field, it grows depending on a pair of factors. It requires both the soil's nutrients and a steady supply of moisture. Just so the aggregates and elements, and the six bases of sensory contact, have come to be dependent on a cause. If the causes break up, they will cease. And here also my translation of the Chinese parallel, where the same exchange is instead attributed to a nun called Vira. This bodily shape is not self-created, nor is it created by another. It has arisen through the conjunction of conditions, and by the dissolution of conditions it will be obliterated. Just as any seed in the world arises in dependence on the great earth, and grows in dependence on earth, water, fire and wind, so it is also with the aggregates, elements and sense-spheres. Through the coming together of conditions they arise, being separated from those conditions they will be obliterated. I am entirely separated from the darkness of ignorance. Having realized the quietude of extinction, I dwell in peace, established in the eradication of the influxes. Evil Mara, I know you. Make yourself disappear and go. I just note that in as a general tendency, that in the Samyukta Agama and also in the other Samyukta Agama, but definitely in this Samyukta Agama, the Teris at the end always make a more explicit statement of their level of attainment reached, which is not found in the Pali versions. End of comment. The first verse negates the idea of creation and expresses the conditionally arisen nature of this body. The simile given in the second verse illustrates this law of dependent arising. It may be pointed out that this simile is not one chosen at random. It echoes the idea behind the Buddha's statement already quoted, Kammang kettang vinyanang bijang tanha sineho. Kamma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. Here the Venerable Thiri is replying from the point of view of Dhamma, which takes into account the mental aspect as well. It is not simply the outward visible image, as commonly understood by nama rupa, but that image which falls on consciousness as its object. The reason for the arising and growth of nama rupa is therefore the seed of consciousness. That consciousness seed grows in the field of kamma, with craving as the moisture. The outgrowth is in terms of aggregates, elements, and bases. The cessation of consciousness is none other than Nibbana. Some seem to think that the cessation of consciousness occurs in an arahant only at the moment of his parinibbana, at the end of his lifespan. But this is not the case. Very often, the deeper meaning of important suttas have been obliterated by the tendency to interpret the references to consciousness in such contexts as the final occurrence of consciousness in an arahant's life, Charimaka Vijnana. What is called the cessation of consciousness has a deeper sense here. It means the cessation of the specifically prepared consciousness, Abhisankata Vijnana. An arahant's experience of the cessation of consciousness is at the same time the experience of the cessation of name and form. Therefore, we can attribute a deeper significance to the above verses. In support of this interpretation, we can quote the following verse in the Muni Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. Sankhaya vattuni pamaya bijang sineyang asa nanopumpa vecce Save muni jatik kayanta dasi takkang pahaya na opeti sankham. Having surveyed the field and measured the seed, he waters it not for moisture. That sage in full view of birth's end lets go of logic and comes not within reckoning. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Having comprehended the grounds, having crushed the seed, he would not nurture it with moisture. Truly, that Muni, a seer of the final end of birth, having abundant thought, cannot be designated. End of comment. By virtue of his masterly knowledge of the fields and his estimate of the seed of consciousness, he does not moisten it with craving. Thereby he sees the end of birth and transcends logic and worldly convention. This too shows that the deeper implications of the Mahanidana Sutta concerning the descent of consciousness into the mother's womb have not been sufficiently appreciated so far. Anusaya, or latency, is a word of special significance. What is responsible for rebirth, or punabhava, is craving, which very often has the epithet ponobhavika attached to it. The latency to craving is particularly instrumental in giving one yet another birth to fare on in samsara. There is also a tendency to ignorance, which forms the basis of the latency to craving. It is the tendency to get attached to worldly concepts without understanding them for what they are. That tendency is a result of ignorance in the worldlings, and it is in itself a latency. In the Sutta terminology, the word nisaya is often used to denote it. The cognate word nisita is also used alongside. It means one who associates something, while nisaya means association. As a matter of fact, here it does not have the same sense as the word has in its common usage. It goes deeper to convey the idea of leaning on something. Leaning on is also a form of association. Worldlings have a tendency to tenaciously grasp the concepts in worldly usage, to cling to them dogmatically and lean on them. They believe that the words they use have a reality of their own, that they are categorically true in their own right. Their attitude towards concepts is tinctured by craving, conceit, and views. We come across this word nissita in quite a number of important suttas. It almost sounds like a topic of meditation. In the Channovada Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, there's a cryptic passage which at a glance looks more or less like a riddle. Nissitasya chalitam, anissitasya chalitam natthi, chalitya sati passaddhi, passaddhiya sati nati nahoti, natiya asati agati gati nahoti, agati gatiya asati chutupapato nahoti. Chutupapate asati nevidha nahurang na ubhayamantare esif antadukkasa. To the one attached there is wavering. To the unattached one there is no wavering. When there is no wavering, there is calm. When there is calm, there is no inclination. When there is no inclination, there is no coming and going. When there is no coming and going, there is no death and birth. When there's no death and birth, there's neither a here nor there nor a between the two. This itself is the end of suffering. Comment, translation by Nyanamoli. There's wavering in one who is dependent. There's no wavering in one who is independent. When there's no wavering, there's tranquility. When there's tranquility, there's no bias. When there's no bias, there's no coming and going. When there's no coming and going, there's no passing away and reappearing. When there's no passing away and reappearing, there's no here, nor beyond, nor in between. This is the end of suffering. And here my translation of the Samyukta Agama parallel, which is a little bit more detailed. You should now develop proper recollection of the great teacher according to the maxim taught by him. If there is dependency, there's agitation. If there's agitation, there's inclination. If there's inclination, there's no tranquility. If there's no tranquility, then there arises coming and going. If coming and going arises, then there's future birth and death. Because there's future birth and death, there's future appearing and disappearing. Because there's future appearing and disappearing, there's birth, old age, disease, death, sadness, sorrow, vexation, and pain. In this way, this entire great mass of dukkha arises. According to the maxim taught by the great teacher, if there is no dependency, there is no agitation. If there is no agitation, there is no inclination. If there is no inclination, there is tranquility. Because there is tranquility, there arises no coming and going. If no coming and going arises, there is no future appearing and disappearing. If there is no future appearing and disappearing, there is no birth, old age, disease, death, sadness, sorrow, vexation, and pain. In this way, this entire great mass of dukkha ceases. End of comment. It looks as if the ending of suffering is easy enough. On the face of it, the passage seems to convey this much. To the one who leans on something, there is wavering or movement. He is perturbable. Though the first sentence speaks about the one attached, the rest of the passage is about the unattached one, that is to say, the one released. So here we see the distinction between the two. The one attached is movable, whereas the unattached one is not. When there's no wavering or perturbation, there's calm. When there's calm, there's no inclination. The word nati usually means bending. So when there's calm, there is no bending or inclination. When there's no bending or inclination, there is no coming and going. When there's no coming and going, there's no passing away or reappearing. When there's neither a passing away nor a reappearing, there's neither here nor there nor any position in between. This itself is the end of suffering. The sutta passage at a glance appears like a jumble of words. It starts by saying something about the one attached, nissita. It is limited to just one sentence. to one attached that is wavering. But we can infer that due to its wavering unsteadiness or restlessness, there is inclination. The key word of the passage is nati, comment. This suggestion by Venerable Nyanananda is clearly borne out by the Chinese parallel. End of comment. Because of that inclination or bent, there is a coming and going. Given the twin concept of coming and going, there is the dichotomy between passing away and reappearing, chutti uppatti. When these two are there, the two concepts here and there also come in, and there is a between the two as well. Wherever there are two ends, there is also a middle. So it seems that in this particular context, the word nati has a special significance. The person who is attached is quite unlike the released person. Because he is not released, he always has a forward bend or inclination. In fact, this is the nature of craving. It bends one forward. In some suttas dealing with the question of rebirth, such as the Kutuhala Sala Sutta, craving itself is sometimes called the grasping, upadana. So it is due to this very inclination or bent that the two concepts of coming and going come in. Then, in accordance with them, the two concepts of passing away and reappearing fall into place. The idea of a journey, when viewed in the context of samsara, gives rise to the idea of passing away and reappearing. Going and coming are similar to passing away and reappearing. So then, there is the implication of two places. All this indicates an attachment. There is a certain dichotomy about the terms here and there, and passing away and reappearing. Due to that dichotomous nature of the concepts, which beings tenaciously hold on to, the journey in samsara takes place in accordance with craving. As we have mentioned above, an alternation or transition occurs. As for the released person, about whom the passage is specially concerned, his mind is free from all those conditions. To the unattached, there is no wavering. Since he has no wavering or unsteadiness, he has no inclination. As he has no inclination, there is no coming and going for him. As there is no coming and going, he has no passing away or reappearing. There being no passing away or reappearing, there is neither here nor there, nor any in between. That itself is the end of suffering. The Udana version of the above passage has something significant about it. There the entire sutta consists of these few sentences. But the introductory part of it says that the Buddha was instructing, inciting and gladdening the monks with a Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana. Tena kupana samayena bhagava bhikkhu nibbana pati samyuktaya dhammiya kathaya samdasyati samadapeti samuttejiti sampahansiti. This is a point to the fact that this sermon is on Nibbana. So the implication is that in Nibbana, the Arahant's mind is free from any attachments. There is a discourse in the Nidana section of the Samyutta Nikaya, which affords us a deeper insight into the meaning of the word Nisaya. It is the Kacchayanagotta Sutta, which is also significant for its deeper analysis of right view. This is how the Buddha introduces the sermon. Dvaya nissito kva yam kacchayana loko yebhuyenam attitancheva natitanche. Loka samudayam ko kacchayana yatha bhutam sammappanyaya passato ya loke natita sa nahoti. Loka nirodham ko kacchayana yatha bhutam sammappanyaya passato ya loke attita sa nahoti. This word Kacchayana, for the most part, bases its views on two things, on existence and non-existence. Now, Kacchayana, to one who with right wisdom sees the arising of the world as it is, the view of non-existence regarding the world does not occur. And to one who with right wisdom sees the cessation of the world as it really is, the view of existence regarding the world does not occur. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This word Kacchayana, for the most part, depends on a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. End of comment. The Buddha comes out with his discourse in answer to the following question raised by the Brahmin Kacchayana. Sammadikti sammadikti ti bhante pucchati kittavatanu ko bhante sammadikti hoti. Lord, right view, they say. But how far, Lord, is their right view? In his answer, the Buddha first points out that the worldlings mostly base themselves on a duality, the two conflicting views of existence and non-existence, or is and is not. They would either hold on to the dogmatic view of eternalism or would cling to nihilism. Now, as to the right view of the noble disciple, it takes into account the process of arising as well as the process of cessation, and thereby avoids both extremes. This is the insight that illuminates the middle path. Then the Buddha goes on to give a more detailed explanation of right view. Upayupadana vinivesa vinibhandho kvayam kacchayana loko ye bhuyena. Tanchayang upayupadanam chetas adhitanthanam abhinivesa nusayam na upeti na upaliyati na adhitanthati atntameti. Dukkam eva upanjamanam upanjati dukkam niruddhyamanam niruddhyateti. Na kankati na vichikichati. Apparapachaya jnanam evasya etnta hoti, etntavatako kacchayana sammadhitanti hoti. The word kacchayana, for the most part, is given to approaching, grasping, entering into, and getting entangled as regards views. Whoever does not approach, grasp, and take his stand upon that proclivity towards approaching and grasping, that mental standpoint, namely the idea, this is my soul, he knows that what rises is just suffering and what ceases is just suffering. Thus he is not in doubt, is not perplexed, and herein he has the knowledge that is not dependent on another. Thus for Kacchayana he has right view. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This word Kacchayana is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging and adherence. But this one, with right view, does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency. He does not take a stand about myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceasing. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kacchayana, that there is right view. And I have just pasted in the Chinese parallel for this and also the preceding passage. So it also begins by pointing out these two different type of dependencies on existence and non-existence. But then it has an interesting turn that it points out that this is because of grasping contact. And because of grasping contact, one depends on either existence and non-existence. And when there is not this grasping, then not being grasped, the mind is not established. It does not speculate about the self. And then the statement about just dukkha arising, which is arises, and the cessation of dukkha is what ceases. And that one does not have doubt, perplexity. One knows by oneself, and this is called right view. So we see that the main elements of this passage are the same, but the distinct contribution by the altogether somewhat more succinct formulation in the Chinese version is to draw our attention to contact, to grasping on contact. End of comment. The passage starts with a string of terms which has a deep philosophical significance. Upaya means approaching, upadana is grasping, abhinivesa is entering into, and vinibandha is the consequent entanglement. The implication is that the worldling is prone to dogmatic involvement in concepts through the stages mentioned above in an ascending order. The attitude of the noble disciple is then outlined in contrast to the above dogmatic approach and what follows after it. As for him, he does not approach, grasp, or take up the standpoint of a self. The word anusaya, latency or lying dormant, is also brought in here to show that even the proclivity towards such a dogmatic involvement with the soul or self is not there in the noble disciple. But what then is his point of view? What arises and ceases is nothing but suffering. There is no soul or self to lose. It is only a question of arising and ceasing of suffering. This then is the right view. Thereafter, the Buddha summarizes the discourse and brings it to a climax. With an impressive declaration of his via media, the middle path based on the formula of dependent arising. Sabbangatiti ko kacchayana ayameko anto. Sabang natantiti ayam duttiyo anto. Etide kacchayana ubo ante anupagamma majhena tagato dhammang disiti. Avinya pachaya sankhara, sankhara pachaya vinyanam. Vinyana pachaya nama rupam, nama rupa pachaya salayatanam, salayatana pachaya bhasso, bhassa pachaya vidana, vidana pachaya tanha, tanha pachaya upadhanam, upadana pachaya bhavo, bhava pachaya jati, jati pachaya jaramaranam, soka parideva dukkha dumanasupayasa sambhavanti. Eva metasya kivalasya dukkha khandasya samudayo hoti. Avijaya tveva sesa viraga niruddha sankhara niruddho. Sankhara niruddha vinyana niruddho. Vinyana niruddha nama rupa niruddho. Nama rupa niruddha salayatana niruddho. Salayatana niruddha bhassa niruddho. Bhassa niruddha vidana niruddho. Vidana niruddha tanha niruddho, tanha niruddha upadhana niruddho, upadhana niruddha bhava niruddho, bhava niruddha jati niruddho, jati niruddha jara maranam, soka parideva dukkha dumanasupayasa niruddhanti. Eva metasya kivalasya dukkha khandasya niruddho hoti. Everything exists, kacchayana, is one extreme. Nothing exists is the other extreme. Not approaching either of those extremes, kacchayana, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle way. From ignorance as condition, preparations come to be. From preparations as condition, consciousness comes to be. From consciousness as condition, name and form comes to be. From name and form as condition, the six sense bases come to be. From the six sense bases as condition, contact comes to be. From contact as condition, feeling comes to be. From feeling as condition, craving comes to be. From craving as condition, grasping comes to be. From grasping as condition, becoming comes to be. From becoming as condition, birth comes to be. And from birth as condition, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the arising of this entire mass of suffering. From the complete fading away and cessation of that very ignorance, there comes to be the cessation of preparations. From the cessation of preparations, there comes to be the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness, there comes to be the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form, there comes to be the cessation of the six sense bases. From the cessation of the six sense bases, there comes to be the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact, there comes to be the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling, there comes to be the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving, there comes to be the cessation of grasping. From the cessation of grasping, there comes to be the cessation of becoming. From the cessation of becoming, there comes to be the cessation of birth. And from the cessation of birth, there comes to be the cessation of decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the cessation of the entire mass of suffering. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. All exists, kacchana, this is one extreme. All does not exist, this is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. With ignorance as condition, volition formations come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of volition formations. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And below I've just put in the Chinese version here, and it says pretty much the same things. It has a small difference, which I think further supports a general point made by Vinamanyanananda in the second line, when it introduces the dependent arising by first giving the statement of a specific conditionality. It starts, so when it here the middle way, after the middle way, that is to say, because of this, that exists. The rising of this is the reason for the rising of that. That is to say, dependent on ignorance, their formations, and so on, up to the whole great mass of suffering, the dukkha arises, and then the cessation formula. So it reinforces the point made by Vinamanyanananda throughout, that the 12 links are an illustration of the basic principle. End of comment. It is clear from this declaration that in this context the law of dependent arising itself is called the middle path. Some prefer to call this the Buddha's metaphysical middle path, as it avoids both extremes of is and is not. The philosophical implications of the above passage lead to the conclusion that the law of dependent arising enshrines a certain pragmatic principle which dissolves the antinomian conflict in the world. It is the insight into this principle that basically distinguishes the noble disciple, who sums it up in the two words samudayo, arising, and nirodho, ceasing. The rising and ceasing of the world is for him a fact of experience, a knowledge. It is in this light that we have to understand the phrase aparapachaya jnanam evasa etta hoti. Herein is a knowledge that is not dependent on another. In other words, he is not believing in it out of faith in someone, but has understood it experientially. The noble disciple sees the rising and the cessation of the world through his own six sense bases. In the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a verse which presents this idea in a striking manner. Chasu loko samuppanno, chasu kumbhati santavan, channam eva upadaya, chasu loko vihanyati. In the sixth the world arose, in the sixth it holds concourse, on the sixth themselves depending, in the sixth it has its woes. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. In the sixth has the world arisen, in the sixth it forms intimacy. By clinging to the sixth the world is rust in regard to six. And below I have pasted in the Chinese, which is closely similar. And this correspondence between the Pali and Chinese confirms the position of early Buddhism, which is quite different from later tradition. The importance given to a phenomenological approach to looking at the world as what is experienced through the six sense doors, rather than as something existing on its own right outside and independent of the subjective observer. End of comment. The verse seems to say that the world has arisen in the six, that it has associations in the six, and that depending on those very six, the world comes to grief. Though the commentators advance an interpretation of this six, it does not seem to get the sanction of the sutta as it is. According to them, the first line speaks of the six internal sense bases, such as the eye, ear, and nose. The world is said to arise in these six internal sense bases. The second line is supposed to refer to the six external sense bases. Again, the third line is interpreted with reference to the six internal sense bases, and the fourth line is said to refer to the six external sense bases. In other words, the implication is that the world arises in the six internal sense bases and associates with the six external sense bases, and that it holds on to the six internal sense bases and comes to grief in the six external sense bases. This interpretation seems to miss the point. Even the grammar does not allow it. For if it is a case of associating with the external sense bases, the instrumental case would have been used instead of the locative case, that is, chahi instead of chasu. On the other hand, the locative chasu occurs in all the three lines in question. This makes it implausible that the first two lines are referring to two different groups of sixes. It is more plausible to conclude that the reference is to the six sense bases of contact, pasayatana, which include both the internal and the external. In fact, at least two are necessary for something to be dependently arisen. The world does not arise in the six internal bases in isolation. It is precisely in this fact that the depth of the Dhamma is to be seen. Comment. This statement is important to underscore the fact that early Buddhism does not envisage any type of monocausality. This is crucial, I believe, to keep in mind when evaluating the early Buddhist idea of conditionality, causality, dependent arising. Recurrent misinterpretation of karma, for example, is that this means that one is responsible for everything that happens and anything can be attributed to karma. And this is a typical instance of the misunderstanding that neither karma nor anything else in early Buddhist thought is monocausal. It always, any cause or condition pointed out, always operates within a network of various causes and conditions. Even the fact that I get sick is not entirely due to karma. End of comment. In the Samudaya Sutta of the Salayatana section in the Samyutta Nikaya, this aspect of dependent arising is clearly brought out. Chakuncha paticca rupe cha upapajjati chakko vijnanam. Tinnang sangati bhasso, bhassa paccaya vidana, vidana paccaya tanha, tanha paccaya upadana, upadana paccaya bhavo, bhava paccaya jati, jati paccaya jaramaranam, soka parideva dukkha dumanas upayasa sambhavanti, eva metasa kevalasa dukkha khandasa samudayo hoti. Depending on the eye and forms arises eye consciousness. The coming together of the three is contact. With contact as condition arises feeling. Conditioned by feeling, craving. Conditioned by craving, grasping. Conditioned by grasping, becoming. Conditioned by becoming, birth. And conditioned by birth, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Thus is the arising of this entire mass of suffering. Here the sutta starts with the arising of contact and branches off towards the standard formula of paticca samuppada. Eye consciousness arises dependent on paticca, two things, namely eye and forms. In the concurrence of the three is contact. This shows that two are necessary for a thing to be dependently arisen. So in fairness to the sutta version, we have to conclude that the reference in all the four lines is to the basis of contact, comprising both the internal and the external. That is to say, we cannot discriminate between them and assert that the first line refers to one set of six and the second line refers to another. We are forced to such a conclusion in fairness to the sutta. So from this verse also we can see that, according to the usage of the Noble Ones, the world arises in the six sense bases. This fact is quite often expressed by the phrase Ariyasa Vinaya Loko, the world in the Noble Ones' discipline. According to this noble usage, the world is always defined in terms of the six sense bases, as if the world arises because of these six sense bases. This is a very deep idea. All other teachings in this Dhamma will get obscured if one fails to understand this basic fact, namely, how the concept of the world is defined in this mode of noble usage. This noble usage reveals to us the implications of the expression Udayatta Gamini Panya, the wisdom that sees the rise and fall. About the noble disciple, it is said that he is endowed with the noble penetrative wisdom of seeing the rise and fall. Udayatta Gamini Panyaya Samannagato Ariyaya Nibbhedikaya. The implication is that this noble wisdom has a penetrative quality about it. This penetration is to the rigidly grasped, almost impenetrable incrustation of the two dogmatic views in the world, existence and non-existence. Now, how does that penetration come about? As already stated in the above-quoted Kacchayana Sutta, when one sees the arising aspect of the world, one finds it impossible to hold the view that nothing exists in the world. his mind does not incline towards a dogmatic involvement with that view. Similarly, when he sees the cessation of the world through his own six sense bases, he sees no possibility to go to the other extreme view in the world. Everything exists. The most basic feature of this principle of dependent arising with its penetrative quality is the breaking down of the power of the above concepts. It is the very inability to grasp these views dogmatically that is spoken of as the abandonment of the personality view, Sankhaya Ditti. The ordinary worldling is under the impression that things exist in truth and fact, but the noble disciple, because of his insight into the norm of arising and cessation, understands the arising and ceasing nature of concepts and their essenceless or insubstantiality. Another aspect of the same thing, in addition to what has already been said about Nisaya, is the understanding of the relatedness of this to that, Ida Pachayata, implicit in the law of dependent arising. In fact, we began our discussion by highlighting the significance of the term Ida Pachayata. The basic principle involved is itself often called Paticca Samuppada. This being, this comes to be. With the arising of this, this arises. This not being, this does not come to be. With the cessation of this, this ceases. This insight penetrates through those extreme views. It resolves the conflict between them. But how? By removing the very premise on which it rested, and that is that there are two things. Though logicians might come out with the law of identity and the like, according to right view, the very bifurcation itself is the outcome of a wrong view. That is to say, this is only a conjoined pair. In other words, it resolves that conflict by accepting the worldly norm. Now, this is a point well worth considering. In the case of the 12 links of the formula of dependent arising discovered by the Buddha, there is a relatedness of this to that Ida Pachayata. As for instance, all be illustrated above by the two links birth and decay and death. When birth is there, decay and death come to be. With the rising of birth, decay and death arise, and so on. The fact that this relatedness itself is the eternal law is clearly revealed by the following statement of the Buddha in the Nidana Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. Avijja pachaya bhikkhave sankhara. Ya tatra tatatha avitatatha ananyatatha idam pachayata ayam bhuchati bhikkhave paticca samuppada. From ignorance as condition, preparations come to be. That such is therein, the invariability, the not otherwiseness, the relatedness of this to that, this monks is called dependent arising. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. With ignorance as condition because of volitional formations. Thus, because the actuality in this, the inerrancy, the not otherwiseness, specific conditionality, this is called dependent origination. End of comment. Here the first two links have been taken up to illustrate the principle governing their direct relation. Now let us examine the meaning of the terms used to express that relation. Tatha means such or thus, and is suggestive of the term yatha bhuta jnana dasana. The knowledge and vision of things as they are. The correlatives yatha and tatha express between them the idea of faithfulness to the nature of the world. So tatatha asserts the validity of the law of dependent arising as a norm in accordance with nature. Avitatatha, with its double negative, reaffirms that validity to the degree of invariability. An anyatata, or not otherwiseness, makes it unchallengeable, as it were. It is a norm beyond contradiction. When a conjoined pair is accepted as such, there is no conflict between the two. But since this idea can well appear as some sort of a puzzle, we shall try to illustrate it with a simile. Suppose two bulls, a black one and a white one, are bound together at the neck and allowed to graze in the field as a pair. This is sometimes done to prevent them from straying far afield. Now, out of the pair, if the white bull pulls towards the stream, while the black one is pulling towards the field, there's a conflict. The conflict is not due to the bondage, at least not necessarily due to the bondage. It is because the two are pulling in two directions. Supposing the two bulls somehow accept the fact that they are in bondage and behave amicably. When the white bull pulls towards the stream, the black one keeps him company with equanimity, though he is not in need of a drink. And when the black bull is grazing, the white bull follows him along with equanimity, though he is not inclined to eat. Similarly, in this case too, the conflict is resolved by accepting the pairwise combination as a conjoined pair. That is how the Buddha solved this problem. But still the point of this simile might not be clear enough. So let us come back to the two links, birth and decay and death, which we so often dragged in for purposes of clarification. So long as one does not accept the fact that these two links, birth and decay and death, are a conjoined pair, one would see between them a conflict. Why? Because one grasps birth as one end and tries to remove the other end, which one does not like, namely decay and death. One is trying to separate birth from decay and death, but this happens to be a conjoined pair. Conditioned by birth, monks, is decay and death. This is the word of the Buddha. Birth and decay and death are related to each other. The word jara or decay on analysis would make this clear. Usually by jara we mean old age. The word has connotations of senility and decrepitude. But the word itself implies both growth and decay, as it sets in from the moment of one's birth itself. Only there's a possible distinction according to the standpoint taken. The question of a standpoint or a point of view is very important at this juncture. This is something one should assimilate with the meditative attention. Let us bring up a simile to make this clear. Now, for instance, there could be a person who makes his living by selling the leaves of a particular kind of tree. Suppose another man sells the flowers of the same tree to make his living, and yet another sells the fruits, while a fourth sells the timber. If we line them up and put to them the question, point to that tree, is this tree mature enough? We might sometimes get different answers. Why? Each would voice his own commercial point of view regarding the degree of maturity of the tree. For instance, one who sells flowers would say that the tree is too old if the flowering stage of the tree is past. Similarly, the concept of decay or old age can change according to the standpoint taken up. From beginning to end, it is a process of decay. But we create an artificial boundary between youth and old age. This again shows that the two are a pair, mutually conjoined. Generally, the worldlings are engaged in an attempt to separate the two in this conjoined pair. Before the Buddha came into the scene, all religious teachers were trying to hold on to birth while rejecting decay and death. But it was a vain struggle. It is like the attempt of the miserly millionaire Kosia to eat rice cakes alone, to cite another simile. According to that instructive story, the millionaire Kosia, an extreme miser, once developed a strong desire to eat rice cakes. As he did not wish to share them with anyone else, he climbed up to the topmost story of his mansion with his wife and got her to cook rice cakes for him. To teach him a lesson, Venerable Mahamoggallana, who excelled in psychic powers, went through the air and appeared at the window as if he is on his arms rounds. Kosia, wishing to dismiss this intruder with a tiny rice cake, asked his wife to put a little bit of cake dough into the pan. She did so, but it became a big rice cake through the Venerable Thera's psychic power. Further attempts to make tinier rice cakes ended up in producing ever bigger and bigger ones. In the end, Kosia thought of dismissing the monk with just one cake, but to his utter dismay, all the cakes got joined to each other to form a string of cakes. The couple then started pulling the string of cakes in either direction with all their might to separate just one from it, but without success. At last they decided to let go and give up, and offered the entire string of cakes to the Venerable Thera. The Buddha's solution to the above problem is a similar let-go-ism and giving up. It is a case of giving up all assets, sub upadi padinissanga. You cannot separate these links from one another. Birth and decay and death are intertwined. This is a conjoined pair. So the solution here is to let go. All those problems are due to taking up a standpoint. Therefore, the kind of view sanctioned in this case is that one leads to detachment and dispassion, one that goes against the tendency to grasp and hold on. It is by grasping and holding on that one comes into conflict with Mara. Now, going by the story of the millionaire Kosiya, one might think that the Buddha was defeated by Mara. But the truth of the matter is that it is Mara who suffered defeat by this sort of giving up. It is a very subtle point. Mara's forte lies in seizing and grabbing. He is always out to challenge. Sometimes he takes delight in hiding himself to take one by surprise, to drive terror, and cause horripilation. So when Mara comes round to grab, if we can find some means of foiling his attempt or make it impossible for him to grab, then Mara will have to accept defeat. Now let us examine the Buddha's solution to this question. There are in the world various means of preventing others from grabbing something we possess. We can either hide our property in an inaccessible place or adopt security measures, or else we can come to terms and sign a treaty with the enemy. But all these measures can sometimes fail. However, there is one unfailing method, which in principle is bound to succeed. A method that prevents all possibilities of grabbing, and that is letting go, giving up. When one lets go, there is nothing to grab. In a tug of war, when someone is pulling at one end with all his might, if the other suddenly lets go of its hold, one can well imagine the extent of the former's discomfiture, let alone victory. It was such a discomfiture that fell to Mara's lot when the Buddha applied his extraordinary solution. All this goes to show the importance of such terms as Nisaya and Idapachigata in understanding this Dhamma. Comment: I am not entirely sure, but I assume that the reference here is to the Buddha letting go of his life force at the request of Mara. End of comment. We have already taken up the word Nisaya for comment. Another aspect of its significance is revealed by the Satipatthana Sutta. Some parts of this sutta, though well known, are wonderfully deep. There is a certain thematic paragraph which occurs at the end of each subsection in the Satipatthana Sutta. For instance, in the section on the contemplation relating to body, Kayanupassana, we find the following paragraph: Iti ajhattang va kaye kayanupassi viharati, bahiddha va kaye kayanupassi viharati, ajhatta bahiddha va kaye kayanupassi viharati, samudhaya dhammanupassi va kayasming viharati, vaya dhammanupassi va kayasming viharati, samudaya vaya dhammanupassi va kayasming viharati, atntika yoti va panasya satipatchupattita hoti, yavadeva jnanamattaya patissatimattaya, anissito cha viharati na cha kinchi loke upadhyate. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating the arising nature in the body, or he abides contemplating the dissolving nature in the body, or he abides contemplating the arising and dissolving nature in the body. Or else the mindfulness that there is a body is established in him only to the extent necessary for just knowledge and further mindfulness, and he abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world. Comment: I find it very significant, these four different modes in the part, which I like to refer to as the refrain, as it comes after each of these exercises. And these seem to, in my understanding, and I have discussed this a little bit more in detail in an article on exploring Satipatthana in Study and Practice, which I will make available in the forum. In my understanding, this refers, it is a progression, and at the same time a progression to three alternatives and one fourth mode, which is always relevant for any type of practice. So the first one is the practicing mindfulness internally and externally, and eventually both. And I understand this to refer to being aware of phenomena within ourselves and then within others. The second, and this is an alternative, it is connected with the va, with the Pali term for or. We contemplate rising, passing away, or both. And in my understanding, this builds on that first, having explored the whole field of mindfulness, internal and external, and then all the phenomena experienced are seen as changing, as impermanent. And based on that comprehensiveness, that spatial comprehensiveness, and that temporal dimension of change, then comes being established in just being mindful. And in my understanding, this is where the idea of bare awareness comes in within the Satipatthana Sutta. Just being mindful for the sake of the continuous knowing and awareness. But the important point is that this bare awareness is informed by the previous groundwork done in appreciation of impermanence. And all of these three alternative modes, one way or another, they all have to culminate, lead up to, and result in dwelling independently without clinging to anything. That is the point at which practice is aimed, and that is the measuring rod for genuine practice of Satipatthana. If we become increasingly able to dwell independently and increasingly able not to cling to things. Even though I find this extremely important from a practical perspective, I need to say that the formulation in the two parallels to the Satipatthana Sutta is quite different, and it does not have all these elements. So here is my translation from the Madhyama Agama, again taking the body contemplation as an example. In this way, a monk contemplates the body as a body internally and contemplates the body as a body externally. He establishes mindfulness in the body and is endowed with knowledge, vision, understanding, and penetration. This is reckoned how a monk contemplates the body as a body. So we find that, in my personal view, absolutely crucial dimension of impermanence is not mentioned. And also the dwelling independently is not mentioned. Then here I have from the Ekottarika Agama, and this is even more complicated in a way, because in the Ekottarika Agama this refrain part is always different. And I think this is probably due to the problem of transmission. The Ekottarika Agama was transmitted by oral memory, and then also there are a number of problems with its translation, so it's less reliable. But anyway, I wanted to give one version, and this is the one found for the last of the body contemplation, the contemplation of a corpse. And before I read it, I wanted to mention that the part I give in square brackets is justified by the occurrence of this phrase in other instances of this refrain. So here it goes. In this way, a monk contemplates his own body and experiences joy in himself by removing evil thoughts and being free from worry and sorrow. This body is impermanent, of a nature to fall apart. In this way, a monk contemplates his own body internally, he contemplates the body externally, and he contemplates the body internally and externally, understanding that there's nothing in it that he owns. End of comment. A similar paragraph occurs throughout the sutta under all the four contemplations, body, feeling, mind, and mind objects. As a matter of fact, it is this paragraph that is called Satipatthana Bhavana, or meditation on the foundation of mindfulness. The preamble to this paragraph introduces the foundation itself, or the setting up of mindfulness as such. The above paragraph, on the other hand, deals with what pertains to insight. It is the field of insight proper. If we examine this paragraph, here too we will find a set of conjoined or twin terms. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body externally, and then he abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. Similarly, Hereby it's contemplating the rising nature in the body, or hereby it's contemplating the dissolving nature in the body. And then, hereby it's contemplating both the arising and dissolving nature in the body. Or else, the mindfulness that there is a body is established in him only to the extent necessary for knowledge and remembrance. This means that for the meditator, even the idea there's a body, that remembrance, is there, just for the purpose of further development of knowledge and mindfulness. And hereby is independent and does not cling to anything in the world. Here too, the word used is anisita, independent, or not leaning towards anything. He does not cling to anything in the world. The word nisaya says something more than grasping. It means leaning on or associating. This particular thematic paragraph in the Satipatthana Sutta is of paramount importance for insight meditation. Here too, there is the mention of internal ajhata and external vahidda. When one directs one's attention to one's own body and another's body separately, one might sometimes take these two concepts, internal and external, too seriously with a dogmatic attitude. One might think that there is actually something that could be called one's own or another's. But then the mode of attention next mentioned unifies the two as internal-external, anjhatta-bahidda, and presents them like the conjoined pair of bulls. And what does it signify? The two are not to be viewed as two extremes. They are related to each other. Now let us go a little deeper into this interrelation. The farthest limit of the internal is the nearest limit of the external. The farthest limit of the external is the nearest limit of the internal. More strictly rendered, ajhatta means inward and bahidda means outward. So here we have the duality of an inside and an outside. One might think that the word ajhattika refers to whatever is organic. Nowadays, many people take in artificial parts into their bodies. But once acquired, they too become internal. That is why in this context, ajhattika has a deeper significance than its usual rendering as one's own. Whatever it may be, the farthest limit of the ajhatta remains the nearest limit of the bahidda. Whatever portion one demarcates as one's own, just joining it and at its very gate is bahidda. And from the point of view of bahidda, its farthest limit and at its periphery is ajhatta. This is a conjoined pair. These two are interrelated. So the implication is that these two are not opposed to each other. That is why, by attending to them both together as ajhatta bahidda, that dogmatic involvement with the view is abundant. Here we have an element of reconciliation which prevents adherence to a view. This is what fosters the attitude of anisita, unattached. So the two, ajhatta and bahidda, are neighbors. Inside and outside as concepts are neighbors to each other. It is the same as in the case of arising and ceasing mentioned above. This fact has already been revealed to some extent by the Kacchayanagotta Sutta. Now if we go for an illustration, we have the word udaya at hand in Samudaya. Quite often this word is contrasted with attagama, going down, in the expression udayatagamini panya, the wisdom that sees the rise and fall. We can regard these two as words borrowed from everyday life. Udaya means sunrise and attagama is sunset. If we take this itself as an illustration, the farthest limit of the forenoon is the nearest limit of the afternoon. The farthest limit of the afternoon is the nearest limit of the forenoon. And here again we see a case of neighborhood. When one understands the neighborly nature of the terms Udaya and Attagama, or Samudaya and Vaya, and regards them as interrelated by the principle of Idapanchayata, one penetrates them both by that mode of contemplation, the rise and fall of the body together. Samudaya Vaya Dhammanupasiva Kayasmin Viharati, and develops a penetrative insight. What comes next in the Satipatthana passage is the outcome or net result of that insight. The mindfulness that there is a body is established in him only to the extent necessary for pure knowledge and further mindfulness. Atmatikayo divapanasa satipachupatita hoti yavadeva jnanamataya patisatimataya. At that moment, one does not take even the concept of body seriously. Even the mindfulness that there is a body is established in that meditator only for the sake of yavadeva, clarity of knowledge and accomplishment of mindfulness. The last sentence brings out the net result of that way of developing insight. He abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world. Not only in the section on the contemplation of the body, but also in the sections on feeling, mind and mind objects in the Satipatthana Sutta, we find this mode of insight development. None of the objects taken up for the foundation of mindfulness is to be grasped tenaciously. Only their rise and fall is discerned. So it seems that what is found in the Satipatthana Sutta is a group of concepts. These concepts serve only as a scaffolding for the systematic development of mindfulness and knowledge. The Buddha often compared his Dhamma to a raft, nittantaranattaya no ghanattaya, for crossing over and not for holding on to. Accordingly, what we have here are so many scaffoldings for the upbuilding of mindfulness and knowledge. Probably due to the lack of understanding of this deep philosophy enshrined in the Satipatthana Sutta, many sects of Buddhism took up these concepts in a spirit of dogmatic adherence. That dogmatic attitude of clinging on is like the attempt to cling on to the scaffoldings and to live on in them. So with reference to the Satipatthana Sutta also, we can understand the importance of the term Nisaya. Comment. Yeah, my attempt again to summarize this builds precisely on this notion of Nisaya, on this idea of dependency. And my understanding is that the basic trajectory we have been doing so far in these four sermons is lining up to some extent with the insight knowledge as mentioned before. So sermon 1 on Namarupa Pariccheda Jnana. And now sermon 2, 3 and 4 related to the second one of Paccaya Parigraha. The understanding of conditionality here being presented by first of all showing that the dependent arising is not confined to the 12 links, but much rather these are exemplifying a principle. And in the last sermon last week, the issue of rebirth and that the entire compass of dependent arising can be understood even without the ability to recollect one's past lives. And now really pinpointing the application of the principle to various even daily situations through this idea of nisaya, of dependency, of looking at dependencies and seeing how through the contemplation of Satipatthana the quality of anicitta, of being independent, can be cultivated. Thank you for your attention.